Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Conversations at the Review of Democracy. My name is Lorena Dracula. I'm an assistant editor here at Revdem, and it is my great pleasure to introduce our esteemed guest today, Professor Michael Frieden. Professor Frieden, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
We are very excited to have you. Professor Frieden is a leading political theorist and emeritus professor at politics at Oxford University and professorial fellow at Mansfield College. He has written numerous widely acclaimed books and articles, and while he is best known for his work on political ideologies, we are here today to discuss a somewhat different topic, his latest book. The book is called Concealed Silences and Inaudible Voices in Political Thinking, and it just came out in the end of 2022 and deals with uncovering concealed silences through which we can gain a deeper understanding of the complexities and nuances of the political and the ways in which it shapes our worldviews and actions. So, Professor, in the book, you employ a kind of a wider understanding of the political than is usual in the existing literature on silences. And even though a large part of the book does connect silences to ideological control, in the very beginning, you stress that understanding the political nature of silence means more than looking at conscious effort towards silencing particular groups. So why is this topic of silences important in political thinking, or why should a political scientist be concerned with this broader understanding of silences?
Well, the main reason is that silences are part of everyday discourse, of everyday language. They're parts of the messages that we transmit to other people, and they're integrated into speech and they're integrated into practice. They punctuate, they support, or they smooth over differences. So silences are either absences or presences. You can say, I recognize this silence here. It's present, or it's something is missing. It's an absence. And in both of these forms, they perform crucial political functions that are not side constraints, they're not accidental or incidental, but they're essential to the political process itself. For instance, silence can be the response to a demand for action or inaction. Will you consider arming Ukraine? You can be completely silent on this, pretend that this is not an issue. It can be an enabling or disabling intervention. Silences, therefore, are interventions, and anything that is an intervention is political. That is one of the features of trying to make a difference or trying to prevent a difference from taking place. So silences can signal tacit consent or holding back or simmering resentment or a failure to put something on the political agenda because it's not noticed or it's not recognized or it's not significant. The right of women to vote was very often silenced because neither men nor women thought this was important in the 18th century. And many women and men across the planet still don't think this is an issue. Silences can also be a point of rupture in political continuity. And rupture is a part of the political, the break of something, the breaking of something. And it can be a focus of rhetorical emphasis, performativity, silence, and indeed politics itself is not just verbal or logocentric. It also has to do with the way that people perform, that people behave, that people act. You can look at political behavior rather than listen to political behavior. Both are very important. And another important issue here is that silence is not only agentic. Both speech and silence are complementary in a way, but silence can be both agentic and crucially non-agentic. And in my recent work on political thinking, I'm interested particularly in non-agentic forms of political behavior. So the aim that I think for me is the most important as a scholar is not advocacy, is not critique, but is what Max Weber calls Verstehen, understanding. I mean, before we can critique something, before we can advocate something, we have to understand what the raw material is, what it looks like, how it behaves, so to speak. And the example I give in my book is the very everyday practice of catching a bus to town. It includes political practices completely unacknowledged. When you catch a bus, you don't think of the political implications, but they're it's dripping with political significance. You identify an aim. I'm going from A to B. You have a purpose. You stand in the queue, which means that you are engaged in the practice of distributing access to a public good. You purchase a ticket, which means obedience to a law that says you shall not use public transport without paying for it. You ring a bell to stop the driver. You're giving the driver command, which is, of course, political, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, and the driver, her or himself, also has the power to start or stop the bus. Yesterday I was a very kind driver, stopped the bus for me, even though there was no bus stop because I was late and running. So that is in a way a political action, because it's a control which also affects other people, in this case me, positively. So power acts in all kinds of mysterious ways or hidden ways that we don't think about this as politics, or as the political. I would prefer not politics, but the political, das Politische, which is actually a much better phrase from German. Basically, politics and the political is all around, and the silences that are interwoven with the political are also all around.
As you mentioned in the book, one of the main instruments of ideology in this case are these superimposed and invented voices, as you call them. And for example, this would be the role of past and future generations in contemporary political and social goals. So in a democratic society, we also have this element of the silent majority that is often invoked as a way to legitimize populist acts. Mm-hmm. So could you elaborate a bit more on these terms? What are these superimposed and invented voices, and maybe explain how through them this ideological manipulation of silence gets manifested in different ways?
Yeah, well, I mean, let's take populism, which is a recent, much talked about, probably too much talked about phenomenon. The populists try to create a world in which certain things are taken for granted. And the way they take things for granted is that they privatize time. It is their time. We know what time is. We were there at the beginning. This is our time. Everybody else doesn't own this, isn't part of this story. Now, this isn't actually said, but it's implicit. And that's a way, that's one of the many, many ways of superimposing a particular narrative on another narrative. You do generally by using palimpsests, which means imposing a particular narrative on another narrative so that the first narrative is obscured or forgotten. A typical example would be the difference between what many people say Columbus discovered America, and the flip side is not the discovery of America by Columbus, but the invasion of the Barbados by the Kingdom of Castile. Now, these are two ways of looking at the same narrative, but one of them is always used supervening and superimposed on the other. And of course, the dominant narrative is that of Columbus discovering America, and then one suddenly realizes that there's a hidden narrative behind this, which looks at it from the point of view of the recipient rather than the point of view of the initiator. And you find this all the time in historical narratives. One way of superimposing is to cover over gaps. I'll give another example. In modern Egypt, the Egyptians are very proud of their pharaonic origins, but this is a completely different civilization. Egypt was conquered by the Muslims in the 7th century, and yet current views of Egyptian history include that, and they're very proud of their pyramids and of this continuity, but there is no continuity. A completely different narrative is superimposed on what actually happened historically, and that is it's quite understandable. It's got various useful social and political purposes and functions, but these are two separate stories that are artificially welded together.
Absolutely, and I think that you discussed the topic of temporality as well, and how its political nature. As soon as you establish finality and the beginning and an end, you have this implication of there being silence before and afterwards, especially when we think about these historical examples and how whenever you construct any kind of narrative or historical inquiry or anything, you're always superimposing some voices and kind of silencing others, obviously. Yes. So
each narrative has its big bang, as it says, its artificial beginning, something from nothing.
Yeah.
But we also mentioned the silent majority. Mm-hmm. The first thing I would say about the silent majority is that there's no such thing as a majority. There are silent collections of minorities that together may or may not form a silent majority. But this is an illusion. And this amalgam of these seven minorities is rarely aware of its own silence. Again, this is a superimposed device which is used to garner political support. There is a silent majority that supports me. This was Richard Nixon in 1969. There is no majority, there is no minority, no single minority, a single majority. There's a complex collection of pluralistic structures. And this also relates to certain linguistic forms in which silences are artificially created. The phrases, needless to say, or self-evident. You find this in the American Constitution. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Are they self-evident? Well, yes, they are self-evident for the people who wrote the Constitution. Or the one that makes me most irritated, the facts speak for themselves. Excuse me, I can't hear the facts speaking at the moment. Can you shut up so that we can hear the facts? No, they are facts don't speak. We superimpose our voices on the facts. They never speak for themselves.
And what I really appreciated kind of when you mentioned this silent majority, a lot of the literature kind of focuses on the majority part, or even critiques always kind of focus on the majority part, arguing, is this silent majority really a majority or not? But rarely do we hear like how silent are they or what is their type of silence or something like that. So
exactly.
I think it's very interesting, and it relates well to another topic that you have, which is tacit consent, where you move away from the analysis of consent and more try to look at why is it tacit and what other forms of consent do we have, or how do they show consent then if they're not voicing it? Yes. So this was my other question, next question. We obviously see that the book establishes that silences can play a fundamental role for the state. So on the one hand, we have in terms of legitimacy, as it is with the example of John Locke's tacit consent. And on the other hand, we have the notion of legality, or the example that you use is the inevitable silences created by constitutions. Mm-hmm. So could you elaborate a bit more on this tension? How do these constitutions create silences or spaces for political acts? And sub-question of that, is there any imaginable destructive consequence of revealing concealed silences in the political sphere?
Now, these are heavy questions. I'll try to deconstruct them bit by bit. So let's start with this phrase, winner takes all, which is typical of the British political system, where one constituency, there's one winner in the constituency, and everybody else is forgotten or silenced after the election. Well, one might just as well call it not winner takes all, but loser takes nothing. Nobody talks about loser takes nothing There's a silence about this, but that is actually crucial because the losers are larger than the winners in these things. You can win a majority with 35 or 40% of the vote. So what happens in the other 60 or 65%? They are silenced once the parliament is filled with those seats. So there are various types of screening and creating taboos over various issues. And many of these have a destructive potential, not just a constructive one. Some silences are very important to maintain peace and quiet and solidarity, or at least some sort of support rather than anger and disintegration. The relaxing of taboos, for instance, can, as we see every day, can trigger religious violence, for example, or fail to protect against national traumas. Some traumas are best left unthought of or unspoken or left to lie. And another form would be disclosing the rationale in negotiations can actually weaken the case. So you have two sides of negotiation. They come to some common language, but when they go home, each side presents it in a different way. So actually you don't want to expose the entire thinking process because these things will collapse. And we're having this yesterday and today with the Northern Ireland agreement or lack of agreement about the flow of goods from Britain to Northern Ireland and then to the Republic of Ireland. So each side will give a slightly different version. And some things are best concealed. If you reveal them, then you sabotage the effort. So there are cases where these things are actually quite important. And to go back to the linearity question, historical linearity itself is an invention. It's not only what happens at the beginning, but also what happens throughout. For instance, binaries, dialectics binaries are great obfuscators. You know, it isn't that you have a plus and a minus on certain issues. I mean, Marxist analysis, I'm putting this a bit crudely, but it is a dialectical binary. But between those binaries is a vast range of things that happens. And dialectics and binaries don't allow for the subtleties of discourse and of difference between those two poles, those two extremes. You talked about also about, you asked about constitutional gaps. Again, this is crucial. Constitutions have to leave some breathing space for actual events, for daily occurrences to take place. You cannot legislate for everything, and it's not only you can't legislate for everything, it will be a catastrophe. It's like, you know, when you fly in an airplane, and you look out of the window and you see the wings slightly moving. And you think, are they going to break? No, the opposite. The flexibility is crucial here. If they were completely rigid, the wings would snap. And the same applies to constitutions. If you have complete rigidity of a constitution, if it lays down the rules for everything, they would snap under the slightest pressure. So you need those gaps where things can grow and change and allow for circumstances and events to fashion contingencies within the agreed framework.
Maybe the final question would then be, for political scientists, what does this mean? Basically, questions about method. Some silences are in the end unavoidable, and researchers can also themselves contribute to coding silences. So what would you say would be the most suitable methods of scholarly investigation that would kind of integrate and engage with what you call listening for silences? Yeah. And so there's another aspect of it, which I also wanted to ask about, because there is a definite methodological concern here between revealing and inventing silences. So if you could also comment a bit on this, in my case, like, it looks like a question of balance, as how do we find the balance between superimposing or venting voices on the one hand, and on the other hand, not doing nothing about it or leaving the silences as they are?
Yes. Well, I think the basic resource we need is curiosity. Researchers and human beings who aren't curious are missing half of what's important in life. The idea of listening for silences, it relates to Sherlock Holmes' famous story of the dog that didn't bark in the night. And you wonder, well, why doesn't this dog bark? And there's a reason which we don't have to go into now, but this is the question: why isn't this thing happening? Why aren't those women complaining? Why is there an assumption that hierarchical creationism or deism is the only way of looking at the world, and so on and so forth? It's a question of trying to find out what's absent here, this requires not only curiosity, but it requires a certain comparative aspect. So you have to look over a period of time and ask, well, what are the frameworks? What are the epistemological necessities of a particular period? What are they missing out? We also don't know what we are missing out, because we're stuck in our own epistemologies and our own assumptions. And maybe in 200 or 300 years, people will look back at us and say, you idiots, you know, these people, they didn't understand the most basic things about how society functions. So it's the question of for instance, the disadvantages of a linear view of political time, which we mentioned, the normality of plural political solutions to a political enigma. Another thing, the indispensability of fictions, of myths and fantasies. What do they tell us? What are they hiding unintentionally? What are they hiding? How can we crack the code? And it's a question not of unmasking, but of decoding a particular way of how people behave, how people look at things, how people think, how people perform. And that also requires one other thing. It requires the assistance of other disciplines. I've always made the point that the political is not only the domain of politics. In every discipline in the humanities and social sciences, there's always a political dimension, right? And whether this is anthropology or history or literature or theology. Theology is chock-a-block with political assumptions about hierarchy, about commands and this sort of thing, about sacred texts. These are all, they have a strong political dimension. So what each of those neighboring disciplines possess partial tools for unlocking sciences. So we have to stand back and say, okay, let's look at it from this angle. Maybe if we look at it from that angle, each time we may get a little insight from other disciplines into understanding our own discipline, understanding how we think politically, and that type of silences that we preserve or promote, whether this is consciously or, as I keep saying in this book, or unconsciously, which is for my mind much more interesting than the deliberate silences or silencing. That's only a small part of what's happening.
Yes, especially in terms of these epistemological apparatuses that we have, there is always, as you said, another aspect that is unconscious, that we just do not have the capability at this moment to reveal these silences or to stop concealing them or etc.
Yeah, I just wanted to say Pierre Bourdieu, the French sociologist, has this wonderful sentence: it goes without saying because it comes without saying. It's a gem of a sentence. It's beautiful. because it goes without saying is a very common phrase that we use. It goes without saying because it comes without saying.
And especially the parts of the book where you analyze Bourdieu's stance on regular social norms and how we understand them, and how this is also a form of silence where we do not kind of perceive in what kind of society we are living in, just because it's customary, just because it's everyday practice, because it just does not come to mind at all.
And here's a good example of how a political theorist can learn from a cultural sociologist.
And so could you still please comment a bit on the other question, which is how does a researcher kind of find this balance without inventing silences? Like, how can we be sure not to, we probably cannot be sure, and we will be inventing silences, as it is with the example of the historiographer that is kind of always superimposing some silences. But this is this very difficult kind of tension between what some post-colonial thought has taught us about these voices that are being kind of concealed or inaudible, but at the same time, who is the subject who is speaking?
Yes, well, this is a crucial aspect in modern anthropology. Do we interfere as we explain, as we research into certain activities? And of course, up to a point, we do. There's this classic example of this invented experiment where a subject is wired up to electrodes, and the observer is supposed to press a button, you know, and each time the electric current is raised up and up and up, and so we just want to see the limits of tolerance, and the wired up person is pretends to scream, but they go on and on and on. Now the point is, you can only do this experiment once, because once it's made public, everybody knows about it, and you can't repeat it. And this is the limits of intervention of research of scholarship into the subject matter that you're studying. So yeah, it may be that we invent silences, but I mean, the invention of silences is no different from the invention of speech, or the invention of behavior, or the invention in any subject or literature. Literature flourishes on imaginative invention, right? Which is crucial. I mean, invention or imagination as invention is part of who we are as human beings. So we wouldn't want to stifle this. And yes, we can get it wrong. We can understand silences that don't actually exist. But it's very rare. I mean, I think when you look at the hundreds of types of silences that societies are engaged in every day, if you miss out a few or misidentify a few, it doesn't matter, because you're looking at the complexity and bulk of a series of practices, and there's always a margin of error in every profession.
Thank you. Yes. Do you think there is anything else that we haven't covered that you would kind of want to stress about your book and the aim of the book and what we may be silenced throughout this conversation?
Well, only to say that the notion of silence is as important as the notion of speech, because silence always involves speech. Even as the two of us are talking, and I'm having a few silences by which I try to compose my thoughts. So silences can also have rhetorical importance. I mean, a teacher asking a question to a group of students, and there's silence, and then the teacher has to react somehow to that silence and negotiate it or retreat from it. So in every form of human interaction, silences are both, as you said earlier, both destructive and constructive. And sometimes the same silence does both at the same time. And sometimes a particular silence has different dimensions. Commemoration, for instance, it involves solidarity, but it can also involve hatred or sadness. if you have even some commemoration of a national tragedy. So, I mean, there are these simultaneous layers. And so we need to unpack as far as we can or disentangle the various dimensions. And that's what makes silence so important. We are always looking, maybe I should say this as well, as students of politics, and in this case, as students of political sciences, we're always looking at the micro, not the macro. It's the nuances. It's the move from the bombastic explanation of ideologies, some single events, or indeed as political thinking as something singular and dramatic, to having a magnifying glass, saying, actually, look, let's look more closely at these things. And we see that hundreds of things are happening. It makes life much more complicated for the researcher, but much more exciting.
Okay, thank you once again for the conversation and that you shared your time and expertise with us today. It was truly a privilege.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to have this conversation, which I greatly enjoyed.
We were discussing Michael Frieden's new book, Concealed Silences and Inaudible Voices in Political Thinking, published in 2022. This is a book which offers invaluable insights into the complexities of silences and has significant implications for the field of political theory. We encourage you to explore it, as well as Professor Frieden's many other publications and contributions to both political theory and intellectual history. We also invite you to join us again for future episodes of our podcast as we continue to explore the most pressing issues and debates in politics and beyond. Thank you for listening, and until next time.